Today, we're going to begin the what we call a side study. We've had a number of them in the Revelation, where particularly when a symbol or symbols appear in more than one place, and the symbol in particular that we're going to be talking about today and reading about is the heads and the horns. And you'll remember we sent an email out about that. And we identified we'd be reading in the first volume and the third volume, probably a little different paging than I gave you, but it's right there. And I'm going to ask for those who like to have their book, we're also going to look in the second volume. So really, volume 1, 2, and 3 we'll be reading from at some point. Just a heads up on that. There's so much good information because there's so much of this is related to history, dealing with the heads and the horns. But Brother Russell actually writes extensively about it, especially in volume 2 and volume 3. The time periods that we're talking about. So that's where you kind of have, we have to pick and choose how much to read and where, without just being complete overload. Now, with that being said, on the heads and the horns, I'm going to have us look at a couple of scriptures. We're not going to go into a lot of detailed discussion on that at the moment. We're going to look at a few scriptures, and then we're going to read in these volume references. And as we're reading in the volume references, I think then that will help us when we then read the scriptures and go through greater detail. So it's a process, and so we just heads up on that. I'll start by saying that in the Revelation, we're actually picking up in Revelation 13 and verse 1. We're going to be starting this 13th chapter. That is, our side study is in conjunction to us beginning the 13th chapter. In the 13th chapter, we come across first, we're introduced, as it were, to a 10-horned beast, 7 heads and 10-horned beast. We have our dragon mentioned again that we learned about in the 12th chapter. We have a 2-horned beast in Revelation 13, and we have an image of the beast in chapter 13. So, you know, sometimes it's referred to as a beastly chapter, and that's why. It's because this is where we get the most detail regarding the 10-horned beast, 2-horned beast, and image of the beast. And Brother Russell writes extensively on in the 4th volume, 1912 forward. Now, that being said, let's look at Revelation 13 and Sister Carrie. Could you read for us verse 1 through 5, please?
Okay. Revelation 13, 1 through 5. And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon which gave power unto the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months.
Okay, thank you. Perfect. So I just wanted to read this background. We're obviously going to come back into a lot more detail on this, but I just want to identify this is the papal system in Revelation. Papacy is identified as a beast. In Revelation, papacy is identified as a head on the beast. In Revelation, papacy as a religious system is identified as a harlot. In Revelation, as a religious system, papacy is identified as Jezebel. In Revelation, the papal system is identified as Babylon the Great. And there's more. But suffice it to say, in Revelation, papacy is not identified as a horn. In the Revelation, papacy is not identified as a horn. So, in these verses, we're introduced to the beast, 7 heads, 10 horns. The crowns are on the horns. There's names of blasphemy associated with this beast. Now, in the 12th chapter, in verse 3, we were introduced to the great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns. Crowns were on the heads. We identified that dragon as a civil Rome, a civil power, the Roman Empire. We were seeing the tail, as it says, of that dragon, which we identified as Constantine, and the tail end of the pagan Roman Empire transferring to nominally Christian in 313 with the Edict of Milan and religious freedom. So we talked about that. And we discussed how the 7 heads and 10 horns becomes an identifying symbol of the Roman Empire at large. And you and I might think of it almost as saying, like, it represents Europe since the time of the Roman Empire. And we talked about the 7 heads. That a head is what controls an animal, dragon or beast. So that's the form of government that's controlling the dragon or the beast at a specific point in time in history that we would be considering in the context of those scriptures. So the head is the form of government that controls the beast or the dragon at a specific point of time in history. We'll add, now we think in the Revelation, the heads or forms of government are specific to the time when Rome had become Christianized. So the heads, 7 heads in Revelation would depict the forms of government since 313 onward to our very day. So we're not looking at all the forms of government over the Roman Empire, which preceded the Christian era. We don't think the Revelation is identifying that. We'll talk about why, but just let me say that for now. The horns which are upon the head are 10 powers. Horns are powers. And the 10 powers are controlled by the form of government. That's why the horns are on the heads. It's the government that controls the various powers under its jurisdiction or influence. The head controls the horns. The form of government controls the powers under its jurisdiction. as 10 is a complete number, it identifies the Roman Empire as 10 horns, but you might not necessarily always have exactly 10 powers of the Roman Empire. It depends on the point of time in history we are looking at. But the point is that in Revelation, the 10 becomes an identifier for the Roman Empire, the 10 horns. So this phrase, seven heads and 10 horns, in Revelation appears in the 12th chapter of the dragon. We talked about that. We studied that. It appears here in this verses in the 13th chapter, which we just read. And then it appears in another chapter, chapter 17. Let's take a look there. We talked about this somewhat last week. It's true. But let's just read a little bit there again. Revelation 17. let's see. Sister Alice, could you read there for us in Revelation 17? Verses 1 through 3, please.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Revelation 17:1. And there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and talked with me, saying unto me, come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns.
Okay, thank you. So just here, brethren, again, we are reading of this symbolic identification of the Roman Empire, seven heads, 10 horns. It's during the Christianized period of history of the Roman Empire, at least from 313 onward to our day and into the future. We're introduced to this harlot woman. We see that she sits upon the waters, many waters. We know that in this very chapter, we're told that those waters are peoples, nations, and tongues. I'm repeating what I said at the beginning. When we read about the harlot woman, that's papacy as a religious system. We remember that the papal system has a religious element, and it's considered a civil government as well. And the two together are a theocracy, religious government. But it's a false religious government. So the harlot didn't wait for the true husband, which would be Jesus. Instead, she had illicit relations with the kings of earth instead of the one true king of kings. And she established her her theocratic government, if you will, in her kingdom known as Christendom, known as the Holy Roman Empire, so-called Holy Roman Empire, where the popes were crowning kings, and they were the authority. That's the system. That's the papal system in the full sense. That is a beast. But here we see this harlot woman, the religious element of papacy. Sometimes it's not in controlling the government of the Roman Empire. And it's supported by the people, the waters, the people who still believe her religious teachings. And at times, it's shown that she's riding this beast. She's riding the, and that gives her the sense of control or direction. And so she's controlling the Roman Empire. This would probably be as a time during the Holy Roman Empire when the popes were crowning the kings. That's in a simple sense. Okay, I think we could see that, in a general sense. We notice again the names of blasphemy. Just like we read in the 13th chapter, there's these names of blasphemy associated with the papal system because they are claiming to be Christ's kingdom on earth. Okay. Now, we're going to come back and go through all these verses, but trying to lay a little groundwork. Sister Alice, sorry, got a little long-winded there. Could you read again now for us in the 17th chapter, verses 9 through 12, please? 9 through 12.
And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are seven kings. Five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast.
All right. Thank you. Very good. Thank you very much. So again, brethren, just touching on this lightly, we talked about it a little bit last week. The seven heads are seven mountains. So a mountain is a kingdom. So these seven heads are forms of government. A kingdom and a government, pretty close. I will say that a kingdom is generally larger. A form of government is larger than the powers it might control. For example, the Holy Roman Empire had different countries who had kings of their own whom the empire controlled. Here, these seven mountains, these seven heads or seven mountains are the seven forms of government during the Christian era when Rome Empire became Christian era. The woman, this harlot, papacy as a religious system. This woman, who's the harlot, is the papacy as a religious system, has had some control during these seven heads, but it doesn't mean, and I'll explain this in a bit, it doesn't mean she controlled all seven. Said she, I believe that this is showing she's in existence at some point during these seven heads. Well, there's going to be more on that. It obviously raises a question, but bear with me on that. It tells us in verse 10 that of these seven forms of government or heads, five are fallen. They're already passed. There's one currently at the time that this vision is given, and yet there's one yet to come. There's a head or a form of government yet future from the time of the vision. It will last a short while. Then I'm skipping down to verse 12. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings. Now let's take a moment. The seven heads we were just told are ten kings. The seven heads we were just told are seven kings. The ten horns we're now being told are ten kings. You've got seven mountain kings and you've got ten horn kings. Seven mountain kings, seven head kings, 10 horn kings. What we're saying is these 10 horns, these 10 powers are smaller kings who give their power unto the head king, the one of the seven head kings. So again, the picture is that the horns are on the head because the head directs the animal. It directs the horns. It directs the power under their authority. So it seems a little confusing, but once we grasp that, it makes it a lot easier to interpret these symbols into the future. Seven heads and 10 horns. Seven heads are kingdoms or forms of government. The 10 kings are individual smaller kingdoms or powers that are under the overarching authority of the one of the heads. So now without going into more detail here, let me take a breath and just ask, is there a question on that so far? Or it's pretty straightforward. Sister Carrie? Oh, you muted yourself. Sorry.
Are these successive? You mentioned last time, not necessarily simultaneous, but they can be in a succession.
Yes, heads, the seven heads are definitely in succession. You only have one head at a time. You only have one form of government at a time. The horns are also successive. We're going to read about that in Daniel 7. That's where we're going to go next. But it's true that the 10 represents a complete number. You don't necessarily always have exactly 10 powers under the influence of one of the heads. But more or less, you have various smaller kings or powers give their power to the head that's in control at the time. So during the Holy Roman Empire period, there were various countries who had princes who gave their support to the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. So he would have been the head and they would have been the horns. Okay. So Sister Carrie, was that helpful? Hope I hit on that. Okay. So we're going to leave this here. The identifier of seven heads and 10 horns in Revelation appear in the 12th chapter on the dragon, great red dragon, appears in the 13th chapter on the beast, and appears here in the 17th chapter. And this is where we get a little more detail. Brother Adi.
So maybe I'm misunderstanding, but are you saying that each head, when it appears on the scene, has 10 horns at the time, which is complete powers? Or are the 10 horns split up among the seven heads?
I'm saying that the 10 horns is an identifying symbol for the Roman Empire, and at any given time, you can have more or less of the 10 numerically. So the first, just to say this, the first head might have seven horns or powers under its control, and the second head might have three horns or power under its control, that sort of thing.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Sister Debbie.
I'm lost. But in verses 9 and 17, 9, it said there are seven heads and there are seven mountains. And then in verse 10, there are seven kings. Is that the same thing as the seven heads?
Yes.
Seven kings?
Because a mountain represents a kingdom.
Okay, because I thought the mountain was the government.
The kingdom is a form of government.
Okay.
That's just another name for a government. Okay. Thank you. Sister Alice.
The way I remember it easiest is to think of the map of Europe. And that would be like the 10 horns. It's the area that is under control of a head. But the head would be like the one in the government or the person in control at that time. And then he goes away and the next one comes and he goes away and the next one. So there are 7 stages, but the 10 horns, 7 stages are the heads, but the 10 horns are this same area that they're controlling. I don't know if that would agree, but that's the easiest way for me to understand it.
No, I think that's good. I think that's what we're saying as well, which is very good. So we had this map in mind. I'm just kind of jockeying my screen around a little bit. sorry. Brother Chris, go ahead.
When we, witness to others at the fair and stuff and Revelation comes up, we really stress that Revelation is a book of symbols. But we also say that we think the numbers are literal, like the 144,000, et cetera. So when we say the 10, horns, would we make that modification in our explanation that numbers can also be like an identifier, like the 12 apostles, as opposed to it being actually literal, as you're trying to say? It can, as Sister Alice and your comments are, that the 10 horns are those under the authority of the mountains, the empires, as it were. Does that sound like a reasonable explanation as to?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Okay. So this map, as you can see, we have, this is going to come up in a few moments in our reading, but since it was brought out, this isn't, Europe is up higher mainly. We're just seeing the southern part of Europe. But I brought this up, I planned to show this because I wanted us to see that here's Rome and here's Ravenna. And Ravenna was a place of power and authority in the time periods that we're going to be reading, as well as Rome. I wanted us to see their location. And I also wanted you to see Constantinople, Byzantium, which is here. Today it's known as Istanbul, but the name previously had been Byzantium, but when Constantine moved his seat of authority from Rome to Byzantium, he renamed it his capital, Constantinople. Now there's reasons why the place of authority shifts. There's reasons why. I'm just going to make a quick statement on that because otherwise it'd raise questions, of course. During the time we're going to be reading about in the volume shortly, some of the ruling authorities moved to Ravenna because they were trying to protect the peninsula of Italy. They were trying to protect the peninsula of Italy from the northern invading Germanic hosts and the Huns, which would come from the north. Now, you might say, yes, some come from the east, but they still have to enter the Italian peninsula from the north if they're coming by land. And Rome was way down here. Now, if you are the ruler, you want the better part of your army surrounding you to protect you and your court. But you also want to protect the area you're controlling. So we'll read, and when you and I read in history, that various rulers of the empire moved the capital up to Ravenna, they were trying to move their forces to be able to protect the Italian peninsula from invaders by land. Okay, that's one. Constantine moved his empire, his seat of authority, over to Constantinople, because as you can see, that's the nearest land bridge. It's not a land bridge. There's water there. I'm sorry. I shouldn't say a land bridge. It's the shortest gap from getting from Asia Minor into Europe, if you were coming this direction. And at his time, that empire would have been, that still would have been, first it would have been, think of it as a form of, Persians on one hand, but then after that, it wasn't long into the 600s, it was the, Muslims. So this became a very critical place to strategically have your capital and your forces. The other strategic place is over here, and there's a long history there that will come up. The Muslims were coming around this way, and various Gothic tribes were involved there, but that's a little later. But just a couple simple observations to explain why Constantine would have left Rome for here, and why some of the later rulers over the western part of the empire would have gone up to Ravenna. But the constant for you and me to remember is that the Bishop of Rome is just that, the Bishop of Rome. And Rome, with its antiquity, is a had by nature its own power of recognition. We just state that to state that. And we'll come back to this, after a little bit here. But let me then just shrink this down a little bit, if I can. There we go. Okay. So let's leave Revelation, take a look in Daniel, the 7th chapter, Daniel 7. And in Daniel 7, and we'll be revisiting this for a good reason, but we're just going to jump into verse 7. And Sister Gina, I'm going to ask you to read in Daniel 7. I'm going to have you read 7 through well, the 7 and 8 at first, but let me first say before you start, is that you all will remember that this is the night vision that Daniel got of these four empires, and each one was successive after the other. This is like our metallic image dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. You had four empires, each one successive after the other. And so you have these four beastly empires. And they're the same empires, but it's just heaven's view that they're beastly. And the fourth one is the Roman Empire, where we're going to be reading. It's the longest. And that's the one that has the most detail. It's the longest and has the most detail. So we're just going to jump in here. And Sister Gina, please, 7, 7 and 8.
After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots, and behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of man, and a mouth speaking great things.
Okay, so leave your mic open. I'm going to have you read more in a moment. I'm just going to state that this fourth beast, it's not descriptive like an animal, like the previous beast, like a lion or a leopard. It's the worst. And it has the iron associated with it. It's the Roman inflexibility of their armies as they went forth conquering. But we're at a point here where we're reading it. It says it had 10 horns. You notice it does not say 7 heads. It does not say 7 heads. But here it's emphasizing 10 horns. And the 10 horns remind us of the metallic image had 10 toes. And the thought is, again, just the 10 represents a completeness. But it does make us think about the revelation. We have our 10 horns here. And yet, in verse 8, while there are 10 horns to this beast, there's an 11th. There's another one. It's not one of the 10. It's an 11th. We'll read on that more. And it's unique because it is a little horn. And if a horn means power, it's demonstrating this little horn has less actual power. And this little horn, as we know, we've studied this, this is papacy. This is the papal system. And it was little because the papacy does not have their own army. The papacy as a religious system relies on the armies of the kings or horns that it controls. So it's only a little horn. It's not one of the 10. But like papacy, like we read in Revelation 13, it has a mouth that speaks great things. These are the blasphemies that we read about elsewhere, and that's the papal system. Now, we see that before this little horn is set up, there were three previous horns that were plucked up. Three previous horns. So, as we had said, there can also be a succession to the horns. As we say, there was a succession to the head. And all that means, we're going to read about it, but all it really means is one of the horns had more power than the others, then another horn had more power than that horn, and then a third horn had more power than the previous two, and then we come to our little horn. So it's hinting at a historical period of time that we're going to identify and talk about in when we read. Now, Sister Gina, come down to us here in same chapter, and what we were just reading was Daniel's dream. Now we're going to read on the angel interpreting the dream to Daniel. So we're just going to, again, jump in on that. We're going to cover the same material, but now it's the interpretive part. So please read verse 16 through 21 to start.
I came near unto one of them that stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made me know the interpretation of the things. These great beasts, which are four kings which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, which devoured, break in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet. And the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than its fellows, I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them.
All right. Thank you, Sister Gina. So I'm going to have you read a little bit more in a moment, but let's identify this. These four beasts are four great kings. And we know what those are. We know that it's Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and then Rome. But we read that these 10 horns are also kings, and they are the powers. And it tells us these horns are on the head. And it goes on to tell us that there came up an 11th, or a little horn, that was the little horn, but it again has a mouth that's speaking great things, and it has eyes showing that there's a certain amount of wisdom or foresight associated with it. This is again papacy, and Satan's behind papacy. So there's a certain amount of wisdom there in the eyes, but there's these great verbal claims coming out of its mouth. And it's by this means that the papacy has control over the horns, as they have the various powers. And it is this little horn that makes war against the saints. And that fits perfectly with what we understand historically about the papacy. But let's read a little bit more. Sister Gina, could you then read for us, let's say, 23 through 26.
Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall rise after them. And he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 kings. 26. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end.
All right. Very good. Thank you. So here again, brethren, we're told the 10 horns are 10 kings. That's exactly what we were told in Revelation 17, where we read the 10 horns are 10 kings, but they are smaller in comparison to these four great kings or four great kingdoms. So, without trying to repeat all this, we recognize that the times and dividing the time is our 1260 year period from 539 AD to 1799. This is the period that in Revelation 12, you and I studied that the woman fled in the wilderness from the dragon and that old serpent. So this is identifying for us a time period that this little horn has exercised power over the other horns, 539 to 1799. We generally just refer to it as the Holy Roman Empire. It is when the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, the Popes had the power to crown kings. So this just helps us understand that what we're seeing in Daniel, as we said, it doesn't make mention of the heads per se of this beast, but it identifies the 10 horns. So it connects us back to Revelation, to the 10 horns. But this 1260 year period, that too connects us back to Revelation, and Revelation 12 particularly, where we have the persecuting of the saints and the truth. Same period of time. So I'm going to leave it there, and I'll have us start reading in the volumes, and that'll lead to more discussion. But did anyone have any questions at this point on Daniel 7? Sister Debbie?
It says there in verse 24, forgive my, not seeing as well, but it says the 10 horns are coming out of the kingdom and they're 10 kings and another doth rise after them. Is that like number 11?
That's number 11, but it's just not saying that you have 10 and then there's going to be an 11 like at some future date. It's just saying that there are 10 powers more or less in the Roman Empire, this fourth beast, and that there is another little horn that's not one of those 10, but it's going to exercise undue power using its words and using its eyes. That's okay. Was there any other question on this before we turn to the volumes? Okay. So I just wanted us to see the scriptural background because now we're going to jump into the volumes and, let's start with number 3. Sister Debbie?
I'm sorry, one more question. Could that small horn in Daniel relate to the woman sitting on the beast in Revelation? Over.
We'll talk about that a little later. Thank you. Thanks for your patience, everybody. It does take time, but I think we'll all be helped by reading now in the volumes to get this background. Much of it you're going to have marked up. You're going to have all your notes. We just started this third volume and covered all this material in the last 2 years in our Friday night study. So let's see. Page 70. And Ruth, could you start there? Page 70 and third volume, page 70. I know we're jumping right in. I kind of had to pick and choose. Start with the paragraph that says, oh, sorry, 69 at the bottom, page 69, sorry. 69 at the bottom where the paragraph says now. And just start reading and I'll rudely interrupt you along the way somewhere, sorry.
Now, knowing that the 1260 years began at AD 539, we are enabled to find what would not before have been recognized. Papists themselves are more inclined to date their beginning of power either at the conversion of Constantine and the nominal Christianizing of the Roman Empire in AD 328, or from the presentation of the Papal States to the church by Charlemagne in AD 800. The fact stands, however, that Constantine in no wise recognized civil power as a right or possession of the church. On the contrary, though he favored Christianity, it was rather the church that made the emperor, at least, its associate head, so that the emperor called church councils and meddled in church affairs, though the church was not permitted to meddle in civil matters. The date AD 539, shown by the prophetic measuring rod of 1260 years, is nearly midway between this union of church and empire in AD 328 and its full complete recognition by Charlemagne as the head of all authority, the dispenser of civil as well as religious authority, AD 800. From the time of Constantine, the bishops of Rome had held the most prominent position before the world, and they began ere long to claim an authority over all others in the church as well as in the world, demanding that some one person should be recognized as an authority or head in the church, and that the bishops of Rome should be that one. They claimed that Peter as well as Paul had lived in Rome and that Rome was thus constituted the seat of apostolic authority, and also that by reason of its long having been the seat of the Caesars and the seat of civil government, it held a place of authority in the minds of the people.
Okay, I'll have you hold up there. And Brother James, could you read the next long paragraph, please?
These pleas for supremacy were not readily conceded, however. The spirit of rivalry was abroad, and other bishops in other large cities claimed supremacy also, some upon one and some upon another ground. It was not until AD 533 that the Bishop of Rome was thus recognized by the Emperor Justinian I. This was in connection with a warm discussion in which the Emperor took sides with the Bishop of Rome, recognizing the Virgin Mary's worthiness of adoration and disputing with the Eutychians and Nestorians regarding the distinctions and blendings of natures in our Lord Jesus. The emperor feared that the discussion thus divide the empire, which he was desirous of more firmly uniting. For even at the early day, the nominal church and the empire were one and the same, Christendom. And desiring to have some authority as a standard to settle the dispute and to tell the people what to believe and what to disbelieve, and finding the Bishop of Rome already the most popular of primacy, popedom, or headship, as well as the one most orthodox, the one most nearly in harmony with the emperor's views on the questions, Justinian, by documents not only condemned the doctrines of the Eutychians and Nestorians, but addressing the Bishop of Rome as the head of all and of all the holy thus acknowledged him and desired to assist the Pope in putting down the heresy and in establishing the unity of the church.
Okay. Thank you. You bleeped out for a second there, so I'm just going to say it for the recording's sake that, Justinian the First documented that the Bishop of Rome as the head of all the holy churches and of all the holy priests of God. So that little part, the internet hiccuped. All right. Thank you. So brethren, let's digest this little three paragraphs that we've read. We have a date of AD 328. We have the date of 533. We have the date of 539, and we have the date of 800 brought to our attention. Brother Russell is bringing these dates out in order to help demonstrate the lessons. So let's first ask, what is the kernel point that Brother Russell's trying to bring out of these paragraphs? Anyone can answer that. What's the kernel point Brother Russell's trying to bring out in these three paragraphs? Sister Roseanne.
Well, to me, he's bringing out that, the point of it, that the Pope was in more, his views were more liking to Justinian, and he was trying to bring the empire together and not have these split offs with the Nestorians and the I don't know how to pronounce it. And so he documented in a letter that he was the Pope of Rome was going to be the head of all churches. Whereas before that, all the churches were vying to be the head, of the Christian church. And so the Pope, Justinian put an end to that and claimed the Pope as bishop of all.
That's right on. Very good. So looking at our little map, when we recognize that Brother Russell puts a date in here, in these paragraphs, he says the nominal Christianizing of the Roman Empire in AD 328. Now the Edict of Milan took place in 313, religious freedom. Christians were no longer persecuted. Constantine became the first Roman emperor to convert to nominal Christianity. We had the Council of Nicaea that he called the first great church council in 325. And he decided the question on whether or not God and Jesus were of the same substance, being co-equal or not. He decided that. Okay. So here, Brother Russell says 328, a few years after that, we have the nominal Christianizing of the Roman Empire. But he goes on to say that actually the Holy Roman Empire, as it were, with the Pope crowning a king, didn't happen until AD 800. But Brother Russell goes on to say, what we're really looking for is when the Pope became empowered over all the other bishops, because that's going to help us identify several things. But one is the start for the 1260 year period of papal persecution, that little horns persecution of the truth and the truth people. And he identifies it as 539 AD. But before 539 AD, he identifies the date of 533. And that's this document by Justinian I of trying to consolidate the empire by putting down religious heretical views, by identifying the Bishop of Rome as the head of all the churches and the head of all the priests, because he felt the Bishop of Rome's views were his views. So on our map, what we're seeing is that Justinian I is over here in Constantinople. Let me move this over a little bit. Justinian I is over here, and the Bishop of Rome obviously is over here in Rome. So you have what's considered the eastern part of the empire, and you have what's considered the western part of the empire. And Justinian wanted a spiritual leader to represent the whole empire, and he then, in de facto, ends up making the Bishop of Rome the civil representative in the western part of the empire, even though it's not complete. It's a small beginning, but it works into that. But we're going to talk more on that. We're going to read more on that. But is there any comment more on these paragraphs before we read on? Okay, let's look at over on Sister Connie. Could you read for us on page 74? And right at the very top of the page, we're not going to read those the Latin as much as I know we would love to. Start at the top of the page and read down upon the same occasion, and then I'll interrupt you.
Upon the same occasion, the emperor wrote to the Patriarch of Constantinople. The first paragraph of his letter we quote as follows: Epiphanius, the most holy and most blessed archbishop of this royal city, an ecumenical patriarch, wishing your holiness to know all matters which relate to the condition of the church, we have held it necessary to make use of these ecclesiastical compends, and through these to make manifest what movements are already started, although we are persuaded that you also know of these. And since we had ascertained that certain ones, aliens from the Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church, had followed the heresy of the impious Nestorius and Eutychius, we promulgated an ecclesiastical edict, as your holiness also knows, in which we censored the madness of the heretics. In no manner whatever have we changed, or shall we change, or have we, as your holiness also knows, passed beyond that position of the church which by the favor of God has as yet been preserved. but in all respects the unity of the most holy churches with his supreme holiness, the Pope of ancient Rome, to whom we have written in like manner, has been maintained. For we do not suffer that any of those matters which relate to the state of the church be not also referred to his blessedness, since he is the head of all the most holy churches of God, even especially for this reason, that as often as heretics have sprung up in those parts, they have been repressed, literally pruned off as the sprouts of a tree by the wisdom and righteous decisions of that venerable see.
Okay, thank you. It gives me a headache reading this kind of jargon. However, what's the bottom line, Sister Connie? What's the point of Brother Russell quoting this letter of the Emperor Justinian to the head of the church and of the church in Constantinople? He's called the Patriarch.
That he's stating that the Pope is the head of the church. I can't put it in words right now. My brain is a jumbled today.
Well, that's it. You got it. And I doubt that the Patriarch of Constantinople was very happy to receive this from the Emperor Justinian. He probably thought that he would have the in because he's in the same city. But eventually, over time, not yet, it did lead to a divide between the Eastern Church and the Western Church. The Eastern Church became Roman Catholicism. Note the name, Roman Catholicism, with the Pope as the head. And they used this document of Justinian I as evidence. But the Eastern Orthodox Church would have their patriarchs. And they would have various patriarchs. But the Eastern Orthodox Church would be in the eastern part of the Roman Empire, as it were. That would end up being a division. That's not our focus today. Our focus is still on these horns, these 10 horns and the little horn that comes up. And that's over in the emphasizing in the western part. Sister Cindy?
I have just a really quick question. In Israel, the Dome of the Rock, that was Justinian's, church, I guess. I'm looking at the map, at what point did he make it into Israel? Over.
Well, the Dome of the Rock was Justinian's church. No, I just don't have that information fresh on the top of my head to make an intelligent comment. So I don't want to get sidetracked into talking about Israel history. And I understand it's a logical question, but I'm going to have to refrain from going there. Maybe during the intermission, some brethren can talk on that. Instead, I'm going to go back to, let's read some more here. And Sister Bessie, could you read for us? We're going to still be on page 75. And could you pick up with where it says this, the first official, and then keep reading over onto the next page. I'll rudely interrupt you.
This, the first official recognition of papacy claims, was afterward confessed more and more pointedly by Pontius and succeeding emperors. But even after being recognized as a ruler, as cardinal emperor, for the time it was of no special advantage to papacy beyond the empty name, for Justinian was far from Rome, with his capital at Constantinople. Rome and Italy in general was under the sway of another kingdom, the Ostrogoths, who did not recognize the Bishop of Rome as supreme pontiff, for they were mainly Arians in faith, papacy therefore was exalted and advantaged in name only by the emperor's recognition until the fall of the Ostrogothic monarchy, when its exaltation became an actual fact, indeed, as if by a pre-consecrated arrangement, the emperor at once, ID 534, sent Belirius and an army into Italy. And in 6 years after the Pope's recognition by the emperor, the Ostrogothic power was vanished and their king vintages. And the flower of his army were taken with other trophies to Justinian's feet. This was in AD 539, which is therefore the point of time from which we should recount the desolating abomination set up. Papacy there had its small beginning. There the little peculiar horn needed in Daniel, noted in Daniel's prophecy, Daniel 7, 8, 11, 20, 22, 25, just began to push itself up upon the Roman beast. It began to form or take root 2 centuries before. And in 2 centuries after its small appearance, its look was more shout than its fellows. The others her authorizes or powers in the territory of the old emperor. In its eyes, in its mouth, speaking great swelling words began to develop, and it lorded it over the other horns, claiming divine right to do so.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sister Bessie, is just as the takeaway kernel point here, what is Brother Russell helping us to understand in this paragraph?
That the little horn, which is the papacy, right?
Yes.
It start to develop in 539. This is the main point in this, what I can say. Thank you.
No, that's good. Thank you. I appreciate that. So this is the beginning, 539, of our 1260 years, because even though earlier in 533, Justinian the First had decreed the Bishop of Rome to be the head of the church, he didn't have much authority in Rome because the Ostrogoths were empowered, the local power in Italy. And it was later that Justinian the First sent his army with his general Belisarius to defeat the various Gothic tribes, one of them being the Ostrogoths, and defeat of the Ostrogoths in 539 then allowed for the Bishop of Rome to have more recognition as an authority. It still was growing. It still needed to grow, but it was a, you might say it was a turn, one of the turning points that we see. Okay. Brother Michael.
Yeah, just a question. So can we safely assume then that the Ostrogoths was one of the three horns that was pushed out by the little horn? Because in Daniel, we read of the little horn pushing out the three horns. Can we safely say then that the Ostrogoths was one of the three horns? And if that is true, what are the other two horns that the middle horn pushed out.
Well, I'm going to say, yes, that's true. It was the third. And we're going to read about the other two in the following paragraph. So your question is right on and logical. We appreciate that. So let's press on here. Let's read some more. And, Sister Cheryl, could you read on page 76 at the bottom where it says the prophet? And again, just read on till I rudely interrupt you.
The prophet had said that three horns would be plucked up or rooted out to make room or prepare the way for this peculiar power or horn. And so we find it. Constantine built Constantinople and removed his capital thither. This, through favorable to papacy's development in the seat of the Caesars, was unfavorable to the empire, and soon it was found expedient to the divine to divide the empire. And Italy was thenceforth known as the Western Empire, whose seat or capital was at Ravenna. This was one of the horns. It fell AD 476 at the hands of the Heruli. Another of the horns, which established itself on its ruins. Next came the Ostrogothic kingdom, another horn, overthrowing the Heruli and establishing itself as the ruler of Italy, AD 489. And as we have just seen, it was during the power of this horn, the third to be rooted out to make way for the papal horn, that Justinian acknowledged the papal supremacy. And it was by his orders and by his general and his army that it was plucked up. And as we have seen, its plucking up was necessary to the advancement of papacy to power as a peculiar blending of political and religious power, a peculiar horn differing from its fellows. Indeed, it seems not improbable that the papacy was secretly favorable to the fall of each of these horns or powers, hoping thus to open the way to its own exaltation, just as it finally resulted.
Okay.
With the overthrow of the Ostrogoths.
Sorry.
Okay, sorry.
Yes. I mean, it really does continue. But let's bite this up. So, Sister Cheryl, what is our takeaway in this paragraph?
Well, for Justinian was in favor of putting the papacy at the head of all things, but there was the Heruli, Ostrogoths, and who else was it? But they were unfavorable. The Heruli, Ostrogoths, and the Western Exarchate, they weren't recognizing the papacy as the head, so they needed to be plucked up out of the way so that papacy could have further control and be recognized. So in all the divisions and what was going on, it made this possible. But it was supported by Justinian. And we see, you know, the mixture of the empire, the church and state mixture. And it was getting its beginning here. But the three had to be plucked up first. Over.
Okay, that's good. And I'm glad that you expressed that. Now, so for just a little refinement of that, and I appreciate that, Sister Cheryl. Justinian was not on the scene when the Western Empire was in control. Justinian came later. So Justinian was in the 500s, just to make it simple. Justinian was in the 500s. But the Western Empire was from the time Constantine moved to Constantinople, which is in 330-331, till the time the Western Empire fell in 476. That is the horn, this first horn, that was the power in the Western part of the empire. And it was seated, the authority was seated at Ravenna, not down in Rome. This was up in Ravenna. And It started when Constantine moved way over here to Constantinople. Now, look at that email I sent out. I hope you all have it. But if not, it's okay. You can listen. On that email, let me, I'm pretty sure I put it in here. I hope I did. Hope I didn't lead you to long. See, where is it? Oh yeah. So first page, I'll read and try to follow, me and then we'll talk on it. A few thoughts. Emperor Constantine converted to nominal Christian about 312 AD, issued the Edict of Milan 313 AD. That was religious freedom. He built and moved to Constantinople in 330 AD. Constantinople was formerly known as Byzantium. Before long, Italy became known as the western part of the empire from 330 to 476, which Brother Russell calls the Eastern Exarchate in the first volume, page 258. We're going to read that. This should not be confused with the latter Eastern Exarchate, which started about 554. No, don't confuse the two. Think of Brother Russell using the term Eastern Exarchate as similar to this Western Empire. It's the same time period. Exarchate means a leader. And so as I was saying, the Eastern Exarchate is just the leader representing the East, even though that leader happens to be in the West. So let's keep reading. The last ruler of the Western Empire was Romulus Augustulus. He was defeated and killed. That was the first horn. Between 395 and 474, there were five different emperors in the East, five different emperors over in Constantinople, the real seat of power. Between 395 and 476, there were 13 different emperors in the West. They're the lesser power. They're representing the East, really, but they still call them emperors. That's why that audacious name, Romulus Augustulus, he was considered the last of the old Roman Empire of the West. So I put that information in here just to demonstrate that over in Constantinople, you had five different emperors. They're the real powers of the time. But there were 13 different lesser emperors over in the West, in Ravenna. But the next little line, he, that is Romulus Augustulus, was defeated by Odoacer of the Heruli. And the Heruli continued from 476 to 489. This is the second horn. Now the Heruli are over there in Italy and Ravenna area, in the western part of the empire. They were defeated, that is the Heruli, they were defeated by Theodoric of the Ostrogoths in 489. The Ostrogoths continued from 489 to 539, although they later had some power, they had a resurgent. Yet this is the third horn was plucked up in 539. And then the next little line, note that Ostrogoth means East Goths and were dominated by the Huns for a time until Attila the Hun died. The Visigoths means West Goths. Other Germanic tribes, I don't know the name, how to pronounce it, Thuringians, Heruli, Vandals, Franks, Lombards, and Servi. Just a note, when it calls them Germanic tribes, it mainly means they're coming from the north, north of Italy. Not just from the land area of Germany as you and I recognize it today, for example. But it just means basically these were from the north. The Gothic tribe known as the Franks and Lombards are going to come into our story in two more centuries, in the 700s. We're going to read more about the Franks and the Lombards. Brother Russell will bring this out. But read a little further here. The Ostrogoths had their capital in Ravenna in northern Italy. They were defeated in 539 AD after a long siege by Emperor Justinian's first general, Belisarius. This is brought out in the footnote in Gibbon's famous Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. They note that there had been a letter written inside Ravenna, and they found that it had been mailed and received outside of Ravenna. And on that letter, it was dated 539, showing that the siege had ended with Belisarius being victorious and the Ostrogoths defeated. That opened the city of Ravenna. So let's hold there on that reading on this paper. But does that help understand that we're talking about these three horns, these first three horns, as a time period from 330 AD down to 539 AD, that they were successive horns, each one plucking the other one up until now we get to 539. See, a couple centuries have taken place. The rest of the 300s, all of the 400s, and the early part of the 500s. So it's showing this time span of the power control over in Italy regarding Ravenna and Rome. Okay, so does that generate any comments or questions? Okay, so we're going to read more on this. See how it flushes out a little bit further here. And Brother Adi, could you read for us on page 77, that next paragraph with the overthrow?
Rick, it's 11.
Oh, it is. Oh, I didn't even pay attention. Thank you. I got so wrapped up in it. All right. Thank you. Sorry. We'll come back next week to that point.